This is Audible.
Lone Star Audio presents an unabridged recording of The Widower's Two-Step by Rick Riordan, narrated by Tom Stetschulte. This work is copyrighted 1998 by Rick Riordan. This recording is copyrighted 2002 by Recorded Books, producer and publisher of Lone Star Audio. Trace Navarre has just hours of apprenticeship time to serve before he can go for his PI license. Staking out a musician suspected of stealing a demo tape should be a piece of cake. But his attention wanders just long enough for fiddle player Julie Kearns to be gunned down before his eyes. He should just back away and let the cops investigate. But backing away has never been Trace's strong point. And now, The Widower's Two-Step.
Chapter 1.
Could you please tell your kid to be quiet?
The guy standing in front of my park bench looked like he'd stepped off a Fleetwood Mac album cover, circa 1976. He had that Lindsey Buckingham funhouse mirror kind of body, unnaturally tall, bulbous in the wrong places. He had the fro and the beard and the loose-fitting black martial arts pajamas that just screamed Maud. He was also blocking my camera angle on the blue 68 Cougar across San Pedro Park, 80 yards away.
Well?
Lindsey wiped his forehead. He'd walked over from his Tai Chi group and sounded out of breath, like he'd been working the moves too hard. I checked my watch. If the lady in the Cougar was going to meet somebody, it should have happened by now. I looked at the Tai Chi guy. What kid? A few feet to my left, Jem made another pass on the swing set, strafing Lindsey Buckingham's students as he came down. He made airplane sounds at the top of his lungs, which was a lot of lungs for a four-year-old, then pointed his toes like machine gun barrels and started firing. I guess maybe it was hard for Lindsey's folks to concentrate. One of them, a short, ovoid woman in pink sweats, was trying to squat for Snake Creeps Down. She ended up rolling on her rump like she'd been shot. Lindsey Buckingham rubbed the back of his neck and glared at me.
The kid on the swings, dumbass!
I shrugged. It's a playground. He's playing.
It's 7:30 in the morning. We're practicing here.
I looked over at Lindsey's students. The pink ovoid woman was just getting up. Next to her, a little Latina lady was doing her moves nervously, pushing the air with her palms and keeping her eyes tightly shut, as if she was afraid of what she might touch. Two other students, both middle-aged Anglo guys with pot bellies and ponytails, lumbered through the routine as best they could, frowning, sweating a lot. It didn't look like anybody was achieving inner tranquility. You should tell them to keep their feet at 45 degrees, I suggested. That's an unbalanced stance, parallel footing like that. Lindsey opened his mouth like he was about to say something. He made a little cough in the back of his throat.
Excuse me, I didn't know I was talking to a master.
Trace Navarre, I said. I usually wear a T-shirt, says Master. It's in the wash. I looked past him, watching the Cougar. The lady in the driver's seat hadn't moved. Nobody else was in the San Antonio College parking lot. The sun was just starting to come up over the white dome of the campus planetarium, but the night cool had already burned out of the air. It was going to be another 90-degree day. Smells from the breakfast taqueria down on Ellsworth were starting to drift through the park. Chorizo and eggs and coffee. On the swing set, Jem came down for another run.
"Eeeow!"
he shouted. Then he made with the machine guns. Lindsey Buckingham glared at me. He didn't move out of the way. "You're blocking my view of the parking lot," I told him.
"Oh, pardon me."
I waited. "Are you going to move?
Are you going to shut your kid up?"
Some mornings. It's not bad enough it's October in Texas and you're still waiting for the first cold front to come through. It's not bad enough your boss sends her four-year-old with you on surveillance. You've got to have Lindsey Buckingham in your face, too. "Look," I told him, See this backpack? There's a Sanyo TLS-900 in there. Pinhole lens, clear resolution from 200 yards. But it can't see through idiots. In a minute, if you move, I might get some nice footage of Miss Kearns meeting somebody she's not supposed to be meeting. My client will pay me good money. If you don't move, I'll get some nice footage of your crotch. That's how it works. Lindsay scratched some sweat droplets out of his beard. He looked at the backpack. He looked at me. Bullshit. Jem kept swinging higher and shouting louder. His skinny brown legs were pinched into an hourglass shape by the swing. When he got to the top, he went weightless, silky black hair sticking up like a sea urchin, his eyes wide, his smile way too big for his face. Then he got a look of evil determination and came swooping down on the Taiji students again, machine guns blazing. The Oshkosh Bagosh Luftwaffe. Don't suppose you guys could move your class, I suggested. Nice place over there by the creek. Lindsay looked indignant. What is firmly established cannot be uprooted. I would have been okay if he hadn't quoted Lao Tzu. That tends to irritate me. I sighed and got up from the bench. Lindsay must have been about 6'5". Standing straight, I was eye level with his Adam's apple. His breath smelled like an Indian blanket. Let's push hands for it, then, I said. You know how to push hands. He snorted. You're kidding. I go down, I move. You go down, you move. Ready? He didn't look particularly nervous. I smiled up at him. Then I pushed. You see the way most guys push each other, hitting the top of each other's chest like bullies do it on television. Stupid. In Taiji, the push is called Liu, uproot. You sink down, get the opponent under the rib cage, then make like you're prying a big tree out of the ground. Simple. When Lindsey Buckingham went airborne, he made a sound like a hard note on a tenor sax. He flew up about 2 feet and back about 6. He landed hard, sitting down in front of his students. On the swing, Jem cut the machine guns, mid-strafe, and started giggling. The ponytail guys stopped doing their routine and stared at me. The lady in the pink sweats said, "Oh, dear." "Learn to roll," I told them. "It hurts otherwise." Lindsay got to his feet slowly. He had grass in his hair. His underwear was showing. Standing doubled over, he was about eye level with me. "God damn it," he said. Lindsay's face turned the color of a pomegranate. His fists balled up and they kept bobbing up and down like he was trying to decide whether or not to hit me. "I think this is where you say you have dishonored our school," I suggested. "Then we all bring out the nunchakus." Jem must have liked that idea. He slowed down his swing just enough to jump off, then ran over and hung on my left arm with his whole weight. He smiled up at me, ready for the fight. Lindsay's students looked uncomfortable, like maybe they'd forgotten the nunchaku routine. Whatever Lindsay was going to say, it was interrupted by 2 sharp cracks from somewhere behind me, like dry boards breaking. The sound echoed thinly off the walls of the SAC buildings. Everybody looked around, squinting into the sun. When I finally focused on the 68 blue cougar I was supposed to be watching, I could see a thin curl of smoke trailing up from the driver's side window. Nobody was around the cougar. The lady in the driver's seat still hadn't moved, her head reclined against the backrest like she was taking a nap. I had a feeling she wasn't going to start moving anytime soon. I had a feeling my client wasn't going to pay me good money. "Jesus," said Lindsay Buckingham. None of his students seemed to get what had happened. The pot-bellied guys looked confused. The ovoid lady in the pink sweats came up to me, a little fearful, and asked me if I taught Taiji. Jem was still hanging on my arm, smiling obliviously. He looked down at his Crayola-designed swatch and did some time calculations faster than most adults could.
10 hours, Trace," he told me, happy. 10 hours, 10 hours, 10 hours."
Jem kept count of that for me. how many hours I had left as an apprentice for his mother before I could qualify for my own PI license. I told him we'd have a party when it got to zero. I looked back at the blue cougar with a little trail of smoke curling up out of the window from Miss Kearns's head. Better make it 13, Bubba. I don't think this morning's going to count. Jem laughed like it was all the same to him. Chapter 2.
What is it with you?
Detective Schaefer asked me. Then he asked Julie Kearns,
what is it with this guy?
Julie Kearns had no comment. She was reclining in the driver's seat of the Cougar, her right hand on a battered brown fiddle case in the passenger seat, her left hand clenching the recently fired pearl-handled .22 Ladysmith in her lap. From this angle, Julie looked good. Her graying amber hair was pulled back in a butterfly clasp. Her lacy white sundress showed off the silver earrings, the tan-freckled skin that was going only slightly flabby under her chin, around her upper arms. For a woman on the wrong side of 50, she looked great. The entrance wound was nothing. A black dime stuck to her temple. Her face was turned away from me, but it looked like she had the same politely distressed expression she'd given me yesterday morning when we'd first met. A little smile, friendly but hesitant, some tightness in the wrinkles around her eyes.
I'm sorry, she told me. I'm afraid surely there's been some mistake.
Ray Lozano, the medical examiner, looked in the shotgun window for a few seconds, then started talking to the evidence tech in Spanish. Ray told him to get all the pictures he wanted before they moved the body because the backrest was the only thing holding that side of her face together.
You want to use English here? Schaefer said cranky.
Ray Lozano and the tech ignored him. Nobody bothered turning off the country and western music that was playing on Julie Kearns's cassette deck. Fiddle, stand-up bass, tight harmonies. Peppy music for a murder. It was only 8:30, but we were already getting a pretty good crowd around the parking lot. A KENS-TV mobile unit had set up at the end of the block. A few dozen SAC students in flip-flops and shorts and T-shirts were hanging out on the grass outside the yellow tape. They didn't look too interested in getting to their morning classes. The 7-Eleven across San Pedro was doing a brisk business in big gulps to the cops and press and spectators.
Tailing a goddamn musician.
Schaefer poured himself some red zinger from his thermos. 90 degrees, and he was drinking hot tea.
Why is it you can't even do that without somebody getting dead, Navarre?
I put my palms up. Schaefer looked at Julie Kearns.
You can't hang around this guy, honey. You see what it gets you?
Schaefer does that. He says it's either talk to the corpses or take up hard liquor. He says he's already got the lecture picked out he's going to give my corpse when he comes across it. He's fatherly that way. I looked across the parking lot to check on Jem. He was sitting in my orange VW convertible, showing one of the SAPD guys his magic trick, the one with the three metal hoops. The officer looked confused.
Who's the kid?
Schaefer asked.
Jem Manos. As in the Irania Manos Agency?
Your full-service Greek detective. Schaefer's face went sour. He nodded like Irania's name in this case explained everything.
The dragon lady ever hear daycare?
Doesn't believe in it, I said. Kid could catch germs. Schaefer shook his head.
So, let me get this straight. Your client is a country singer. She prepares a demo tape for a record label. The tape turns up missing. The agent suspects a disgruntled band member who would have been cut out of the record deal. The agent's lawyer gets the brilliant idea of hiring you to track down the tape. Is that about it?
The singer is Miranda Daniels, I said. She's been in Texas Monthly. I can get you an autograph if you want. Schaefer managed to contain his excitement.
Just explain to me how we got a fiddle player dead in the SAC parking lot 7:30 Monday morning.
Daniel's agent figured Kearns was the most likely suspect to steal the tape. She had access to the studio. She'd had some pretty serious disagreements with Daniels over career plans. The agency thought Kearns might have stolen the tape at someone else's prompting, somebody who stood to gain from Miranda Daniels remaining a local act. As near as I could tell, that wasn't the case. Kearns didn't have the tape, didn't mention it to anybody over the last week. This is not explaining the dead body. What can I tell you? Yesterday, I finally talked to Kearns, told her straight what she was being accused of. She denied knowing anything, but seemed pretty shaken up. Then, when she bolted out the door this morning, I figured maybe I'd been mistaken about her innocence. Maybe I'd stirred things up, and she'd arranged to meet with whoever asked her to steal the tape. Ray Lozano moved Julie's fiddle case off the passenger seat. He sat next to her. He began picking fragments out of her hair with tweezers. "Stirring things up," Schaefer repeated. "Nice fucking method." One of the campus cops came over. He was a heavy guy, a former boxer maybe, but you could tell he hadn't dealt with homicides before. He approached Julie Kearns the way most people do the first time they see a corpse, like an acrophobic sneaking up to the railing of a balcony. He nodded at Schaefer, then looked sideways at Julie.
"They want to know about how much longer it'll be."
He said it apologetically, like they were being unreasonable.
"She committed suicide in the bursar's parking space."
"What suicide?" Schaefer said. The big guy frowned. He looked down uncertainly at the gun in Julie's hand, then the little hole in her head. Schaefer sighed, looked at me. "She was shot from a distance," I explained. "You shoot yourself point blank, the wound splits like a star. Plus, the entrance and exit wounds here are angled down and the caliber of the gun is probably wrong. The shooter was up there, somewhere." I pointed to the top of a campus building where there was a series of big metal air conditioning units making steam. "She was carrying the .22 for protection. Fired it when she was hit because of a cadaveric spasm. The bullet's probably embedded in the dashboard." Schaefer listened to my explanation, then waved his free hand in a so-so gesture.
"Make yourself useful," he told the campus cop. "Go tell the bursar to park it on the street."
The big man walked away a lot faster than he'd walked up. A crime scene unit detective came over and pulled Schaefer aside. They talked. The CSU guy showed Schaefer some ID and business cards from the dead woman's wallet. Schaefer took one of the cards and scowled at it. When Schaefer came back to me, he was quiet, drinking red zinger. His eyes over the thermos cup were the same color as the tea, reddish-brown, just about as watery. He handed the card to me.
"Your boss?"
The words, "Les St. Pierre Talent," were printed maroon on gray. Centered underneath in smaller type, it said, "Milo Chavez, Associate." I stared at the name. Milo Chavez. It did not invoke feelings of goodwill. My boss.
"I don't suppose you came across any reasons why somebody would want to kill this lady, and don't tell me the fucking demo tape was that good."
"No," I agreed. "It wasn't."
"You look for large debts? Irate boyfriends, the kind of background work real PIs do when they're not minding three-year-olds?"
I tried to look offended. "Jim's a mature 4.5.
"Uh-huh. Why meet somebody here? Why drive the 75 miles from Austin to San Antonio and park at a junior college?"
"I don't know." Schaefer tried to read my face.
"You want to give me anything else?"
"Not especially. Not until I talk to my client.
Maybe I should let you make that call from a holding cell."
"If you want." Schaefer dug a red handkerchief the size of Amarillo out of his pants pocket and started blowing his nose. He took his time doing it. Nobody blows his nose as often and as meticulously as Schaefer. I think it's how he meditates.
I don't know how Irania got you this case, Navarre, but you should shoot her for it.
Actually, I know the agent's assistant, Milo Chavez. I was doing Chavez a favor. Ray Lozano was talking with the paramedics about how to move the corpse. The crowd of college kids outside the police tape was getting bigger. Two more uniforms were leaning on the side of my VW now, watching Jem put his magic rings together. The cowboy fiddle tunes were swinging right along on Miss Kearns's cassette deck. Schaefer finally put his handkerchief away and looked down at Julie Kearns, still clenching her .22 like she was afraid it might jump out of her lap.
"Hell of a favor," Schaefer told me.
Chapter 3.
All the way back to the north side, I had to give Jem a lecture about not taking bets on magic tricks from the nice policeman. Jem nodded like he was listening. Then he told me he could do 6 rings at a time and did I want to bet?
No, thanks, Bubba.
Jem just smiled at me and pocketed his 3 new quarters in his Oshkosh overalls. It would have been faster to take McAllister Freeway back to Irania's office, but I headed up San Pedro instead. Going north on the highway, 20 feet off the ground the whole way, all you see are the hills and the Olmos Basin, a few million live oaks, an occasional cathedral spire, and the tops of some Olmos Park mansions. Clean and forested, like there's no city at all under there. San Pedro is more honest. For about 2 miles north of SAC, San Pedro is the dividing line between Monte Vista and the beginning of the west side. On the right are the old Spanish mansions, huge acacia and magnolia trees, shaded lawns with Latino gardeners tending the roses, Cadillacs in the wraparound flagstone drives. On the left are the boarded-up apartment blocks, the occasional mom-and-pop ice house selling fresh watermelons and Spanish newspapers, the 2-room houses with kids in Goodwill clothes peering out the screen doors. Go 2 miles farther up, and the bilingual billboards disappear. You drive past white middle-class housing developments and run-down shopping centers from the 60s, streets that were named after characters in I Love Lucy. The land gets flatter. The ratio of asphalt to trees gets worse. Finally, you get to the mirrored office buildings and the singles apartment complexes clustered around Loop 410. Loop land could be in Indianapolis or Des Moines or Orange County. Lots of character. Irania's office was in an old white strip mall off 410 and Blanco, between a restaurant and a leather furniture outlet. The parking lot was empty except for Irania's rusty Lincoln Continental and a newish mustard-yellow BMW. I pulled in next to the Lincoln, and Jem helped me put up the ragtop on the VW. Then we got our respective backpacks out of the trunk and went to find his mom. The black stencil sign on the door said, "The Irania Manos Agency, your full-service Greek detective." Irania likes being Greek. She tells me Nick Charles in The Thin Man was Greek. I tell her Nick Charles was rich and fictional. He could be anything he wanted. I tell her she starts calling me Nora, I'm quitting. The door was locked. The mini blinds across the glass front of the office were pulled down. Irania had stuck one of those cardboard black and white pointing hands over the mail slot, pointing right. We went next door to Demos and almost collided with a stocky Latino man on his way out. He wore a 3-piece suit, dark blue, with a gold watch chain and a wide maroon tie. He had 4 gold rings and a zircon tie stud and smelled strongly of Aramis. Except for the bulldog expression, he looked like the kind of guy who might offer you credit toward a purchase of fine diamond jewelry.
"Barrera," I smiled.
"What's new, Sam? You come by to get some pointers from the competition?" Samuel Barrera, Senior Regional Director for ITEC Security and Investigations, didn't smile back. I'm sure at some point in his life Barrera must have smiled. I'm also sure he would have been careful to eliminate any witnesses to the event.
The skin around his eyes was two shades lighter brown than the rest of his face and bore permanent oval rings from all those years wearing FBI standard-issue sunglasses before he'd retired into the private sector. He never wore the glasses these days. He didn't need to anymore. The glossy, inscrutable quality had sunk directly into his corneas. He looked at me with mild distaste, then looked at Jem the same way. Jem smiled and asked Barrera if he wanted to see a magic trick. Barrera apparently didn't. He looked back at me and said, "My conversations are with Irania. See you later, then." "Probably so." He said it like he was agreeing that a sick horse probably needed to be shot. Then he brushed past me and got into his mustard-yellow BMW and drove away. I stood watching the intersection of 410 and Blanco until Jem tugged on my T-shirt and reminded me where we were. We went inside the restaurant. 2 hours before the lunch crowd, Manoli was already behind the kitchen counter, carving gyro strips off a big column of lamb meat. It seemed like every time I came in, the column of lamb got skinnier and Manoli got thicker. The place smelled good, like grilled onions and fresh-baked spanakopita. It wasn't easy to get a Mediterranean feel in a strip mall, but Manoli had done what he could. Whitewashed walls, a couple of tourist posters from Athens, some Greek instruments on the wall, bottles of ouzo on each table. Nobody came here for the decor, anyway. Irania was sitting on a bar stool at the counter, talking to Manoli in Greek. She wore high heels and a T-shirt dress, black, of course. She looked up when I came in, then lifted one bony hand and slapped the air like it was the side of my face. "This guy," she said to nobody in particular, disgusted. Manoli pointed his cleaver at me and grinned. Jem ran up to his mom and hugged her leg. Irania managed to tousle his hair and tell him he was a good boy, without softening the look of death she had aimed at me. Irania's eyes are the only thing big about her. They're huge and black-irised, almost bug-eyed, except they're too damn intense to look funny. Everything else about her is small and wiry. Her black hair, her bony frame under the T-shirt dress, her hands, even her mouth when she frowns, like she's made out of coat hangers. Irania slid off the bar stool, came up to me, and frowned some more. She stands about 5 feet tall in the heels, but I've never heard anybody describe her as short. A lot of other things, but never short. "You got my phone message?" I asked. "I got it." "What did Barrera want?" "Let's get a table," she told me. We did. Manoli sat Jem on the counter and started talking to him in Greek. Jem doesn't understand Greek, as far as I know, but it didn't seem to bother either of them. "All right," Irania said. "Give me details." I told her about my morning. About halfway through, she started shaking her head no and kept shaking it until I'd finished. "I don't believe this," she said. "How is it you convinced me to let you do this case?" "Masculine charm?" She scowled at me. "You look good, honey. Not that good." Irania smiled. She looked out the restaurant window, checking the office. Nobody was beating down the door of the Irania Manos agency. No crowds were queuing up for a full-service Greek detective. "Why was Barrera here?" I asked again. Irania slapped the air. "Don't worry about that, Vlaka, honey. He just likes to check up on me, make sure I'm not stealing his business." It was a point of pride, so I nodded like I believed it. Like Barrera needed Irania's divorce cases and employee checks to stay afloat. Like his security contracts with half the companies in town wasn't enough. For the millionth time, I looked at Irania and tried to imagine her back in the days when that competition had been real. Back when her husband, Fred Barrow, was still alive and in charge of the agency. And Irania was anglicized as Irene, the good little assistant to her husband, the sort of famous PI. That was before she'd shot Barrow in the chest. Then he'd been sort of dead. The judge said it was self-defense. Irene had said, "God rest Fred's soul." Then she cashed in her husband's stocks and returned to the old country, and come back a year later as Irania, rhymes with Transylvania, Manos. Tan and very Greek. Mother of an adopted Muslim Bosnian orphan whom she'd named after somebody in a novel she'd read. She'd taken over her husband's old agency and become an investigator like it had been her destiny all along. Business had been sliding ever since. 2 years ago, when I just moved back to town and was thinking about going legit as a licensed investigator, one of my dad's old SAPD friends, who didn't know Barrow was dead, had recommended Fred as the second-best PI in town to apprentice with, just after Sam Barrera. After Sam and I had decidedly failed to hit it off, I'd gone to Fred Barrow's office address and discovered in the first 30 seconds I was there that Irania was the trainer for me. "Is Mr. Barrow here?" "No, he was my husband. I had to shoot him." "That's it on the Kearns case, then?" Irania was saying. "You got what? 20 hours left?" I hesitated. "Jem says 10. "Ah, only 10. It's 20. Anyway, we've got other things to do." "You said I could do this." Irania tapped her fingers on the formica table. They sounded hard, like pure bone. "I said you could try, honey. Somebody gets murdered, that's the end of it. It's a police matter now." I stared at the picture of Athens behind her head. Irania sighed. "You don't want to have this conversation again, do you?" "What conversation?" "The one where you explain why you can't pay me anything this week, then you ask me to babysit?" Her eyes got very dark. "No, honey. The one where we talk about why you want to do this job. You spent a few years in San Francisco doing arm breaking for some shady law firm. You think that makes you an investigator? You think you're too good for a regular caseload? You'll just keep churning the ones that interest you?" "You're right," I said. "I don't want to have this conversation again." Irania muttered something in Greek. Then she leaned toward me across the table and switched to English mid-sentence. "Tell you this. You think you're a big deal coming back to town with your Berkeley PhD and whatever. Okay. You think you're too good to apprentice because you've been on the streets a while. Okay, too. I did teach you the trick with the super glue." She used both hands this time, going out on either side of her face like she was slapping people sitting next to her. "Okay, so you show me one thing. It's even all right you think you want to do this because your dad was a cop. You think you want to do personal favors once in a while, do something out of charity, all right, fine. But that's not what you do to make a living, honey. The job is hard work, which you keep trying not to notice, and mostly it's not personal. You sit in a car for 8 hours with intestinal problems taking pictures of some sleazeball because another sleazeball paid you to. You look at old deeds and talk to boring credit bureau men that aren't even good-looking. You keep the police happy, which means you stay away from anything where people end up dead. Mostly, you don't make much money, so, yeah, maybe you do have to take your kid along sometimes. I'm talking about the bread-and-butter work. I don't know if you can handle that part of it, honey. I still don't know that about you."
"If you're not going to recommend me to the board," I said, "now would be a good time to say so." The coat hangers that made up Irania's body seemed to loosen a little bit, and she sat back in her chair. She looked out the window again, checking for clients. Still no lines outside the office. "I don't know," she said. "Maybe not. Not if you can't take a case when it's good and drop a case when it's bad. As long as you're operating under my license, I can't risk you getting it revoked." I examined her face, trying to determine why the warning she'd thrown out so many times before had a harder edge this time. "Barrera said something to you," I guessed. "He's got pool with the board. Was he pressuring you about me?" "Don't be dumb, honey. I just watched a woman get murdered, Irania. I'd like to know why. I could at least..." "That's right," she said, sitting forward again. "You shake up that Kearns woman one day, and she runs out and gets herself killed the next. What does that tell you about your methods, honey? It tells me you should listen sometimes. You don't blow a surveillance because you're getting impatient. You don't ring the subject's doorbell and ask them to confess to you."
The rims of my ears felt hot. I nodded. Okay. Fingers on the formica.
Okay, what?
Okay, maybe I'll quit, withdraw, unapprentice, whatever you call it. She waved her hand dismissively.
Ah, what? After this many months?
I got up. She stared at me for a few seconds, then looked back out the window like it didn't matter one way or the other to her.
Whatever you want to do, honey.
I started to leave. When I was at the door, she called me. She said,
Think about it, honey. We could treat it as time off. Tell me next week.
I looked over at Manoli, who was telling Jem something in Greek. It must have been a fairy tale by the tone and the gestures he was using.
I told you today, Irania. Next week, she insisted.
I said, sure. Before I could leave, Jem looked over and asked me what kind of party we would have when my hours got to zero. He wanted to know what kind of cake. I told him I'd have to think about it. Chapter 4. When I got back to 90 Queen Anne, my landlord, Gary Hales, was out front watering the sidewalk. It looked like he was doing a good job. A few new cracks had sprouted. A couple of slabs that had started to buckle up last week were buckling up a little more. Gary's got a gray thumb.
Howdy, I told him.
He looked at me like he was trying to figure out who I was. Gary's a pale guy, kind of quivery, his skin washed out blue and his face all liquid. Looking at him with a garden hose is kind of disconcerting because you're never really sure where the stream of water stops and Gary starts.
He said, your lady friends come by.
I sighed. You let her in? A ripple went across his mouth. Maybe it was a smile. Gary's a sucker for the sweet-talking ladies.
You old dog, I said.
What'd she promise you this time? Another ripple.
Yeah. Should make her a key, I reckon.
I walked around to the right side of the house. The yard was crunchy with pecans and mesquite bean pods and red bougainvillea petals. The closest we get to fall colors in South Texas. 90 Queen Anne was a decaying two-story craftsman in a state of major denial. It had a dignified facade, intricate woodwork around the windows, a huge bougainvillea-draped front porch where you could sit out of an evening and sip your margarita. But the white paint had started to peel a long time ago, and the green shingled roof sagged in the middle. Sometime in the 1950s, the whole house had shifted on its foundations, so the right half drooped slightly backward. My mother said it looked paralyzed. I preferred to think of it as extremely relaxed. When I got to the porch of my in-law apartment, Caroline Smith was standing in the doorway, letting the air conditioning escape. She was holding the telephone toward me. Caroline had on her anchor person costume, a white silk blouse and conservative blue skirt and blazer, her dark blonde hair done up big, brushed away from her face, her makeup heavy for the cameras. Only her prescription glasses were out of costume. They were large, black, mousy jobs, left over from her days as a small-time reporter, back when she still called herself Carolyn. She only wore the glasses now when she wanted to see.
So, who's Annie at First Texan? She asked. She sounds cute.
No comment.
Asshole.
Caroline handed me the receiver. Annie at First Texan had pretty much the same question about Caroline, but she finally agreed to give me the information I'd asked her for last Friday about Julie Kearns. Caroline went into the kitchen where it smelled like something was burning. I stood in the middle of the living room and looked around. My laundry had been put away for me. The futon was back into couch position. The swords were off the coffee table and back on the wall rack. Robert Johnson had climbed to the top of the closet and was hiding between two shoe boxes. He peered out at me, hopefully. I shook my head to tell him that Caroline was still here. He made a low growl and disappeared back into the shadows. Annie started telling me about Julie Kern's checking account. Biweekly direct deposits from something called Paintbrush Enterprises, $250 each. Steady for the last 2 months, which was as far back as Annie had pulled the files. A few sporadic paychecks from a temp employment firm in Austin. All other deposits in cash, probably gig money, none of them large amounts. 3 overdrafts at HEB Central Market. The usual monthly bills. Julie's balance at the moment was $42.33, about $40 more than mine. Annie told me I owed her big time for risking her job.
Like Garth Brooks, she suggested, and dinner at La Margarita.
I said it would be fine with me if she had dinner with Garth at La Margarita. I wouldn't stand in the way. Annie called me some unflattering names and hung up. Caroline pulled a cookie sheet out of the oven and said, "Damn." I think the things on the sheet had been chilaquiles in a former life. Strips of corn tortilla and bacon were curled up and smoking. The cheese was brown and the jalapenos were gray. It smelled pretty bad. "Tin foil on the top," I suggested, "and turn it down to 300 degrees next time. That old Wedgwood's like a nuclear reactor in there."
"Damn it,"
Caroline said, pushing up her glasses.
"I've got to be back at the studio for the noon broadcast."
Robert Johnson complained from the closet. I looked down at the burned food, then at my clean living room.
"You shouldn't have done all this."
"No big deal."
"No," I said, "I mean you shouldn't have done it. You shouldn't keep getting Gary to let you in and setting up house. You don't clean your own apartment this much. It makes me nervous."
She leaned back against the sink and raised her eyebrows.
"You're welcome."
I stared out the kitchen window at the crepe myrtle. Caroline dropped her hands on her thighs.
"Jesus, Trace, what am I supposed to do? I've hardly seen you this month. You cancel dinner dates on me 3 times in a row. You leave me waiting outside the Majestic for an hour with 2 goddamn concert tickets. Then I try to do something nice for you.
I'm sorry."
"It's been a hard morning, Caroline."
Sarcastic smile.
"I bet.
Still following some woman around Austin, peeping through her windows with binoculars at night. Poor guy. She was murdered."
The smile flickered around the edges, then disappeared.
She listened while I told her the story. She kept her expression soft and sympathetic, but her eyes weren't totally focused on me. They were moving slightly back and forth, like they were reading math equations, maybe calculating what the murder meant for my job prospects. When I was done, Caroline folded her arms.
"What did Irania say?"
"That I was handling it wrong anyway, end of case."
"What did you say?"
"I quit." After a moment of stunned silence, Caroline looked at her watch. Then she took her purse off the counter and rummaged for something inside. She was trying not to let it show, but I could see the relief loosening up her shoulder muscles.
"So what now?"
she asked. "I don't know. It depends on what Milo Chavez wants."
"You mean you might keep working for him, unlicensed? Like the work you did before?"
She said "before" like it was a euphemism for something one didn't talk about in polite company.
"Maybe," I admitted.
"The last time you did this man a favor, it almost got you killed, yes?"
"Yes."
"I don't understand. I don't see why you can't just..."
She stopped herself. The corners of her mouth tightened.
"Say it," I told her. "Why can't I just use my degree and get a real job teaching English somewhere?"
She shook her head.
"It's not my business, is it?"
"Caroline,
I have to leave, Trace."
Then she added without much optimism,
"You could come back to the studio with me. We could get takeout, spend the afternoon in my dressing room like old times. It might do us some good."
"I have to call Milo."
The frost set in.
"All right."
Caroline closed her purse, then came up and kissed me very lightly, without ever really looking at me. She smelled like baby powder. There were a few freckles on her nose that the makeup hadn't quite covered.
"Sorry I bothered you," she said.
The front door slammed behind her. Robert Johnson came out of the closet as soon as he heard Caroline's car start. He looked out the window suspiciously, then gave me a look of death he must have learned from Irene Manos.
"You want to play Anne Frank when people come over?" I said. "Don't blame me."
He came over and bit me on the ankle, lazily, then headed for the food dish.
Some days, everybody wants to be your friend.
Chapter 5. At sunset, the sky turned the color of cooked eggplant. 7 million grackles descended for a convention in the trees and phone wires above the city. They sat there making a scratching high-pitched sound that was probably screwing up the sonar of every submarine in the Gulf of Mexico. I stood in the kitchen reading the Express News late edition. I'd just started on my third Shiner Bock and was starting to get mercifully numb in the extremities. Julie Kearns had had the good sense to get murdered on a slow news day. She merited a small story on A-12. I received honorable mention for making the 9/11 call. The staff writer had done some homework. He wrote that readers might remember Kearns for her song Three More Lonely Nights, recorded by Emmylou Harris in 1978, or for Julie's more recent work as fiddle player and backup singer to rising local star Miranda Daniels. The police had no leads in the killing, no murder weapon, no useful witnesses. The writer mentioned nothing else about Julie Kearns, none of the immaterial stuff I had learned from following her around town, talking to her neighbors, going through her garbage. For instance, that Julie's favorite food was Thai, that she shopped at the same New Age stores my mother liked, that Julie had played fiddle in country bands since she was 6, but secretly, at night, preferred to listen to Itzhak Perlman, that she drank cheap white wine and owned a parrot. None of that made it into the Express News, just the fact that Julie Kearns now had a hole in her head. The last part of the article talked about what a pain it was having the SAC parking lot cordoned off all morning for the investigation. It quoted some grumpy students who'd had to park several blocks away from class. I thought about Julie Kearns all dressed up nice, fiddle beside her in the 68 Cougar. I thought about the real downside of surveillance, not the boredom like most PIs will tell you, but the times when the subject starts to become a real person to you. I drank more beer. I'd had no luck with the telephone. I'd paged and left messages for Milo Chavez, but his secretary, Gladys, insisted that he couldn't be reached. Milo was somewhere in Bernie, working on a major event. Gladys acknowledged that a major event in Bernie was an oxymoron, but she still said there was nothing she could do for me. Yes, she had heard the news about Julie Kearns. Yes, the police had been by. Yes, she had left messages for Milo about it. No, she still couldn't reach him. No, reaching Les St. Pierre himself, god of talent agents, was out of the question. Why not try back tomorrow? I thanked her and hung up the phone. I was ready to turn in for the day. Unfortunately, time and tide in my weekly dinner at Mother's house would wait for no man. I went to the bathroom and looked at myself in the mirror. "You can do this," I said. Robert Johnson looked up at me sideways from the leaky faucet that doubled as his watering hole. He offered no words of encouragement. I showered and dressed fancy. Jeans with no holes, my Beta Breakers t-shirt, my deck shoes, the newer ones that didn't yet resemble baked potatoes. Then I put the top down on the VW and headed north on Broadway toward Vandiver Street, blasting tinny conjunto music from my AM radio all the way through downtown Alamo Heights. When I stopped at the light on the corner of Austin Highway, a couple of guys in tuxedos and Stetsons in the Mercedes next to me looked over and stared. Once you get to Vandiver, it's easy to find my mother's house, even in the dark. You just go down the row of white post-World War II houses until you find the pink adobe bungalow with the green porch light. Understated. Nobody met me at the door, so I let myself in. Mother was burning frankincense tonight. The Christmas lights were blinking in the pencil cactus, and the hot tub out on the deck was bubbling happily to itself, ready for a party. The general theme of the house was ethnic eclectic, Mexican curios next to Japanese kimonos next to African burial masks.
Two guys I'd never seen before were playing pool in the dining room. They were about my age. They wore tight jeans and boots and denim shirts with the sleeves rolled up to show their triceps. They nodded at me and kept playing. I went down the steps into the kitchen, where Mother and Jess were watching TV. Caroline was on, doing an advertisement for the 10 o'clock news. She said she'd have the latest on the North Side apartment fire.
Trace, honey.
Mother got up, squashed my cheeks together with both hands, and kissed me.
I hope tortilla soup is all right.
Mother was dressed for Zimbabwe. She had on a multicolored caftan and a long black shawl. Her ebony earrings were shaped like the Stoneheads on Easter Island, and her forearms had so many silver bangles on them they looked like slinkies. She was around 55 and looked 35, tops. Jess told me howdy and went back to watching the Oilers game. Jess graduated from Heights a couple of years before I did. We played varsity together. I think he was young boyfriend number 3 or 4 since my mom had gotten her divorce, burned her pot roast recipes, and reinvented herself as a new age artiste.
I expect a full report, Mother was saying. How is Caroline? We never miss the KSAT news anymore. You should tell her to wear that green dress more often, Trace. It's very flattering.
I told her Caroline was fine, and no, we were not living together yet, and no, I didn't know when or if we would be. Mother didn't like the if part very much. She looked disappointed that I wasn't living in sin yet. She told me she recommended it highly.
Huh,
Jess said. He kept his eyes on the ball game. Mother went to stir the soup. She added a bowl of boiled chicken and stewed tomatoes to the broth. I came over to the counter and started chopping cilantro for her.
And work?
Mother looked sideways at me, intently.
Maybe not so great. I've got one job to finish. After that...
She nodded, satisfied, then pushed a strand of black hair back over her ear. Out of habit, I tried to spot any sign of gray. There wasn't any. God knows I'd snuck plenty of looks into her medicine cabinet for Miss Clairol and never found anything more incriminating than vitamin E, rosemary essence, and a few healing crystals. Mother looked at me again and smiled, like she knew what I was thinking and enjoyed it. It was a game she'd been winning for a good 15 years.
Well, she said, I happened to talk with Professor Mitchell at UTSA.
I chopped the cilantro a little harder.
Mother, please, dear. We were just touching base.
Touching base?
Of course. It must have been 10 years since I did that art show with his wife.
In the other room, one of the young rednecks broke a setup and the other one whistled appreciatively. Jess tossed his beer can toward the trash and made it. The Oilers were winning.
So you just happened to run across Mitchell's phone number in your book.
That's right.
I slid the cilantro off the knife blade and into the pot. The cebollas were already grilled and the sour cream was ready. Strips of fried corn tortilla were in a bowl to the side, ready to be stirred in. I wiped off my hands.
And while you were on the phone, I prompted.
Mother shrugged.
All right, I did ask if there are any openings in the English department.
I looked down longingly at the big knife I'd been using.
Well, really, Jackson, he was very helpful.
Only my mother calls me by my first name and lives. She likes to put me in my place next to the first two Jackson Navars, my father and my grandfather, the third in a long line of hopeless males. The phone rang. My mother tried to look surprised and failed miserably.
Good Lord, who could that be?
I bowed to the inevitable and said I'd get it. Mother smiled. I took the phone out onto the deck next to the hot tub, picked up the receiver, and said, Professor Mitchell? A moment of surprised silence on the other end, then a fatherly voice said,
Now, this isn't Trace, is it?
I told him it was. He laughed and gave me the standard knee-high to a grasshopper reminiscences about how long it had been and how glad he was I'd gotten out of puberty. I said I was, too.
Your mother told me you were job hunting, he said.
Yeah, about that. I wanted to apologize for my mother thinking that college teaching jobs grew on trees and fell when ripe as soon as one's parents made phone calls to old friends. Before I could, Professor Mitchell said, "I made your appointment for 11 o'clock Saturday. It's the only day we're all available to interview." I hesitated, then closed the glass door to the kitchen to shut out the pool game and the TV. "Pardon?"
"Well, your mother's timing was perfect, as usual," Mitchell said. "Big stir-up in the department, the hiring committee just forming. So happens I'm on it. 11 o'clock. Will that time work for you?"
A polite no would have done just fine. "Sorry, my mother's just meddling in my life again, and I have a very bright future in private investigations." I kept waiting to hear myself say no. I watched through the glass door as Caroline came on the television again, this time for a news break. Maybe what made me weaken was Caroline's face. Maybe it was a week with almost no sleep, doing surveillance, minding a 4-year-old, or the fact that whenever I closed my eyes now, I saw Julie Kearns in her 68 blue cougar, people with white rubber gloves picking fragments out of her hair with tweezers. When I finally responded to Professor Mitchell, I didn't say no. I said, 11 o'clock Saturday, what the hell? My mother's voice came on the upstairs phone line. She sighed and said, "I've died and gone to heaven." Professor Mitchell started laughing. Chapter 6. The good news Tuesday morning was that Gladys, the secretary, was able to negotiate a lunch meeting for me with Milo Chavez. Actually, Milo was meeting with somebody else, but Gladys figured it might be okay if I dropped in for a few minutes, seeing as there was a homicide to talk about and all. The bad news was that lunch would require money. I tried the ATM on Broadway and Elizabeth, but it played stubborn with me. It told me my checking balance was insufficient for the minimum $20 withdrawal. I tried for a cash advance from credit. Somewhere in New Jersey, the people at Visa laughed long and hard. Plan C. I called my old friends at Manny Forrester and Associates. By 9:30, I had 3 subpoenas. Manny's normal errand boys had been unable to serve. By 11 o'clock, I'd found 2 of the invisible men, dropped the papers at their feet, and gotten away with no more than a few cuss words and a steak knife waved in my face. Not my idea of fun, steady work, but at $50 a subpoena, it wasn't bad emergency income. The third delivery was for a repeat customer, William Burnett, a.k.a. Sarge. I served process on him at least once a month, thanks to Manny Forrester's zealous efforts on behalf of Sarge's wife and creditors. Sarge just kept on smiling and lighting his cigars with the subpoenas, moving from downtown bar to downtown bar. He and I were to the point now where